sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Unemployment at 6.3%. We have a little bit of a headline fiasco to talk about. Dow gets to a record, then not. And our guest, Harry Dent. All this and much more on episode number 362 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hey, welcome to May. This is Andrew Horowitz, and we are hopping along, talking along, and going to bring up some great topics today to talk about because not only do we have a great guest, but some great news items to talk about, some things about the markets that are, I think, very interesting. We saw that last week there was a hodgepodge of information from earnings and economics, and around the world as well, there were some things that happened that were very interesting. You know, for example, you take what's going on, continuing in the Ukraine, and the maneuvers that are going on by Russia, the discussions that are going on with, oh, if you move, I'm going to do this. And, you know, it's all about me, and what I want, and each side, obviously, well, not me, but them, and what the sides want, and what they're going to give, and all that. The markets kind of take each of the information, that news items about the region, a bit in stride for a little while. Then they decide, hey, I'm not going to hold on over the weekend. Markets sell off, even though we saw a pretty good and a very interesting item in terms of unemployment. Boy, we saw 288,000 or so employed and newly added to the payrolls. The unemployment rate goes to 6.3%. We'll talk about that in a second and really decipher what that all means. We saw that there was really a mixed bag when it came to some of the other economics throughout the week. And that kind of, I think, put a little bit of a damper on the move, but realize something. That the goal of whoever the sources were and the guys that were really controlling the strings with the markets was to move the Dow to a record because it was so close. About it only needed about 30 or 40 points on one particular day to get to a record. And why not? You know, we love those records. We love pushing it. And don't forget, we did that exactly into the end of the month. Now, remember, we talk about all the time the whole idea of painting the tape. Painting the tape. It's all about moving up markets and moving up individual positions in order to properly get them valued and squared by the end of the month. And one of the reasons is so that you can get a better overall fee charged to the account and show a very nice return or at least some better return by the end of the month. It reminds me of what's going on right now. I'm in the midst of selling my house and there's a couple of different offers and they're coming in and they're battling back and forth, and you know, one of them is upping it, the other one is upping it, and there's two offers on the table. This is a true story. This is what's going on right now. There's two offers on the table. One of them has a little bit of a strange deal because it's an actual realtor, and what they're doing is they're going to give back their commission and put that into the price, and then you got to calculate what the real price is. And the other one is a straight-up deal. But when you look at them, you wonder, why is one of them better than the other? Well, you have to look at the bottom line, right? Okay, you do the calculations, come up to the bottom line. And then my realtor says, well, I think you should take the other deal. I'm thinking, why would I take the other deal if this one's better? Then I start thinking about it. You know what? This deal may be better for them. It's all about what's good for the agent, right? It's all about what's good for the mutual fund. It's all about what's good for the hedge fund. Obviously, and hopefully, it's good for the seller, the buyer. It's good for the person that has the account at the various funds, et cetera, as well. But when you're dealing with a situation where there's a fee that can be distorted due to a circumstance in the terms of commission, as a good example, sometimes the business gets a little cloudy. That's why we don't do any of that work. That's why in our firm, we don't have any of that commission that clouds any of it. Yeah, we work on a flat fee, for example, but that is good for everybody. Now, of course, you can say, well, the hedge funds work on a flat fee to an extent, and so do the mutual funds. but they have the power to move things in their direction and to benefit themselves. But really, what I'm really focusing in here on is the whole idea of commissions. And, you know, if you are involved with working with, let's say, a financial planner, an investment advisor, broker, insurance, and you're being shown a particular product to buy, in other words, you're being sold something in terms of a product, just be aware that, you know, not all are created equal. In fact, when we look at the mutual fund universe out there as a good example of where you can kind of get confused and where buyers may not know exactly what they're getting themselves into, they come in all sorts of different categories. Now, when I'm talking about categories, I'm not talking about things like, well, equity income and large cap growth and international. I'm talking about categories of how you pay the management fee and how you pay the acquisition fee as an investor to actually get into the fund. Now, there's things called A shares and B shares and C shares and Z shares and X shares and Y shares and all these different things. Here's the bottom line. At the end of the day, you want to look for a no-load fund. You want to look for something that has truly, by the way, no load. I don't mean front-end load waived or something like that, but there's a back-end. I'm not saying that there's no front-end, back-end, but they goose up the internal fee on an annual basis. You want to find a no-load. So oftentimes, you can find the same fund that is offered in different flavors and styles, but it's the same fund. You can find the ABC fund that has a front-end load of maybe 5%, back-end load, maybe a declining of 3%, 2%, 1%, or maybe even an internal fee of 1% higher than you would see, but no front-end or back-end. None of those I like. Now, with a mutual fund, obviously, you're looking to buy and invest and hold for a period of time and let the manager do what they do, et cetera, and all. But at the same time, when we're looking for a mutual fund, which now is going to be somewhat commoditized, I think that you want to find the ones that are institutional-based or no-load. And what we do for our clients in the global allocation strategies is we actually find ETFs that meet the criteria of the investment that we want to be involved in the sector and in the overall asset class. If, in fact, now you need to take this note, if, in fact, it is a very efficient market. Now, let me give you an example. Let's say that you want to invest, for whatever reason, you want to invest in the S&P 500. Well, you can go out and buy all sorts of funds that are all trying to beat the S&P 500. And what they do is maybe active or passive management, and they do all sorts of things to try to get there. At the end of the day, the S&P 500 index is a very efficient index. There is absolutely no reason to go out and try to find a manager that is benchmarking against that as their core style that is going to charge you more money to do so, because you can find that and get that return of the S&P 500, that's your target, from just an ETF, and maybe they'll charge you 0.2% instead of 1.3%. Now, on the other hand, this is also important, if there is a market that's inefficient, if you're going to find a place that you want to invest, maybe let's take a good example would be international emerging bonds on unhedged basis. Well, okay. Well, maybe you want to have someone that is managing those bonds that understands about the overall economies and understands the very detailed information about each of the bonds and all about the potential for maybe early payments or coupons, or maybe look at currencies, you know, understand a bit more about that. You want to find a mutual fund that's actively managed, and I wouldn't go to an ETF. So when you're looking at efficient markets, an ETF usually is the best case because you're going to save a lot of money. That's what we do. If you're looking for a more inefficient market for whatever reason, you probably want to find a manager that, and not only that, not only a manager, but a team that can actually go and be on the ground and talking with management, understanding what's going on in the economy of the locale where they're investing or the locales, and also understanding the currency, and more importantly, the language. You want to have someone who understands what's going on very, very intimately at that place. So those are the two things you want to look at. Kind of a far discussion from the real estate, but I think this is very important to bring up because it's an important way to manage your portfolio. And for those of you that are involved in not only stocks, but also in mutual funds, ETFs and you are doing more longer-term holding than maybe a short-term trading deal, well, I think it's important to look at that as something that's very important. All right, so we're talking about the jobs number. Let's kind of segue to that real quickly. And we saw that there was 280 or so thousand added. Pretty impressive number, right? No question about that. As a matter of fact, whether we look at it as maybe there's some payback from the stormy and wintry and cold weather and all the things that went on, or maybe it was just, you know, a great time and the economy is expanding, whatever you want to call it, fact is 288,000 people are added to the payrolls. Okay, great. No problem. Now, I do have a little bit of a problem with the 6.3% unemployment rate, and let's kind of discuss that a little bit. What does that mean? Well, on a headline basis, it's awesome. The fact is, when you look at the 6.3% unemployment rate, the first thing that pops in my head, I don't know about yours, is, wait a minute, the Fed said that they were actually going to stop the bond buying program and maybe even look into raising interest rates once they saw that 6.5% was reached. Well, that was scrapped, we know that. But where are we now? We're kind of under that level. So that was the target level they had way back when. Now, let's stop for a second and realize that the 6.3% unemployment rate, which was a drop from 6.7%, pretty significant. I mean, it's a big drop. How'd we get here? Well, 800,000 people seemingly, poof, left. Just totally left the whole landscape of looking for a job and the whole area of inclusion in the calculation of what the unemployment rate was. So all of a sudden we have a labor participation rate that dropped down to the levels that hasn't been seen since the 70s. And for whatever reason, 800 people just are no longer in the workforce. Now, how did that happen? I'm not quite sure. But the statistics that they use to come up with this particular unemployment rate that gave us the headline of 6.3% is clearly bent a bit. Now, whether or not this was a revision and some kind of a strange calculation that brought in this number, I can't tell you, and I don't even think they can tell you. But the fact is, this enormous amount of people just dropped off the payroll concept of being in the workforce, and that drove it down. That's not really that good. I'm not even sure if I can look at the unemployment rate as something to even trust anymore. But I will tell you, it is the headline and it excites investors. Overseas, they're probably going to like that a lot, assuming that there's nothing that happens over the weekend at all, or even possibly going to be brought up about Ukraine, et cetera, and Russia. This is going to be a number that you would think they would like from the process, from the thought process that, hey, you know what? This is a number that shows the U.S. is getting much more strong. And at the same time, you know, they'll say, well, you know, even though bond buying may be slowed down and stimulus may be slowed down, it's still not bad. As a matter of fact, it's good. You know what else is good? Doing something nice for your mom. Let me tell you something about Pro Flowers. The fact is that, you know what, Mother's Day is coming up. It is next weekend. Just to give you a quick reminder, if nothing else, you want to listen right now because you could be a hero. And I don't know about you, but it's nice to do something nice, you know, very nice for your mother. And I got to tell you something, there's nothing better than flowers, maybe even some chocolates. And what you get is a great deal here from Pro Flowers. The fact is, I bought not only for my wife, bought Pro Flowers, and they delivered them within a day. They came in this beautiful box and a vase and roses. It was 2 dozen beautiful roses. They give you that little powder that allows, I guess, the roses to last a long time. And they were just tightly, tightly bunched. And the roses themselves were very tight. They opened up. They were beautiful. Colors were just magnificent. And I got to tell you something. The price is right. Here's the deal. So for your mom, you can buy her these flowers, right? You can be the hero. You can be the talk of her day and just brighten her day. It can be delivered. And when you get there to go out to lunch with her, take her out, you know, dad's going to give you the old thumbs up. You're going to be a hero. You can get these unbelievable, beautiful blooms bouquet plus a free glass vase. Listen to this. For just $19.99. Now, you could upgrade to 100 blooms with a pink vase and chocolates for just another $9.99. That's pretty cool. Now, this is a special offer for my listeners. You have to go to proflowers.com, click on the blue microphone in the top right corner, and type in investor. That's proflowers.com. Click on the blue microphone and type in investor. Now, this deal is going to expire at midnight, so make sure you order today. But I would really encourage you to make your mom's day. You're the great guy, great girl. You're just really awesome. You're the hero of the fam. And you are going to see a smile like you never saw, because this is just absolutely beautiful. Proflowers.com. And with us today is Harry Dent. You've heard him before. He is the author of the latest book, The Demographic Cliff. Also, he's the author of the daily newsletter, which is Survive and Prosper, which is free, by the way. It's a free one. You can get that at over at harrydent.com, a free daily newsletter. Harry, how are you?
Great, Andrew.
So I have so many things to talk to you about, because the last time that we talked, there was some discussion about gold. We talked a little bit about housing. And I know that you have some definite commentary, because I read your work, on the markets. But let's maybe start right now in the beginning of this, and let's talk a little bit about gold, because gold has been defying some of the latest predictions from like Goldman and a variety of others that, hey, they thought it was going to go down and really go down hard. And it seemed to be rallying. And it's interesting because when you look at that and you look at where bonds are, even in, it seems like, you know, even if the Fed has taken their foot off the pedal, bonds are still being bought. And you wonder what's going on with the relationships with all of these asset classes. So what's your story on gold?
Well, you know, my story on gold has been the same from the beginning. It's a bubble. It went up 7.7 times between around 1999 and 2011, when it peaked in September. And by the way, in my newsletter, I gave a huge sell signal on silver when it hit $48, $49, its 1980 high, and gold. And gold peaked a little higher, a little later, but it's been going down ever since. And here's the reason, Andrew. It's very simple. We've been saying for years now, not only that gold and silver are a bubble like everything else, and stocks and emerging markets and real estate and all these bubbles keep building and bursting, but that gold is expecting that all this money printing, which is unprecedented, is going to lead to inflation and or hyperinflation, and it's just not the case. And the reason that gold finally broke down after going sideways after $1,934 peak in September 2011, it went sideways for a year, year and a half, and it broke down out of that channel between $1,525 and $1,800 because the U.S. escalated its money printing in QE3 and QE3 plus, and then Japan followed that in early 2013 and tripled their monetary stimulus, I mean, off the reservation, I call it. And you know what happened after that? Inflation went from 2.5% down to 1%, and we're still bordering on deflation in Europe, and even in Japan, they've pushed the inflation rate up some with all the stimulus, but the economy's not responding that much. Exports aren't responding that much. The yen is not going down as much as they thought. So basically, gold finally got what I think I've been saying for years, is that we're in a deflationary, debt deleveraging, financial bubble deleveraging period where we destroy wealth and dollars and debt, and that makes the dollar more scarce and worth more, and it brings prices down, so we get deflation, not inflation. Gold is an inflation hedge. So money printing was supposed to create this massive inflation from government irresponsibility. And what I keep telling people, Andrew, is very simple. Governments, central banks around the world are printing money at unprecedented rates just to stave off deflation like in the 1930s. It's not going to cause inflation, and I think the markets finally got that. But gold got very oversold at 1178, and it's bouncing now. And I actually think that with the Fed tapering, interest rates are going to tick up, inflation tends to come on a lag, and we'll see some inflationary pressures this year. And gold's going to bounce back to $1,430 an ounce, and maybe a little higher, but I do not think it's going to bridge that breakout gap at $1,525. So I'm telling people, if you're still holding on to gold after we told you to sell it in 2011 and silver, hey, don't sell it now quite yet, but if it bounces to 1430 or a little bit higher, sell it, because it the next stop on gold is $700 to $800, and then the next stop after that is its lows in 1998 to 2000, around $250 or $400 at the minimum. So I think gold is a major bust. People think gold is going to protect you. The only safe haven in the last financial crisis in late 2008 was the U.S. dollar versus other currencies. The U.S. dollar is the safe haven, not gold, in a deflationary debt deleveraging crisis.
You know, it's interesting because I looked at this also, and, you know, I think probably both of us scratched our head a little bit about, wait a minute, how come this isn't causing any kind of inflation? You know,
right,
when you look
right.
at you know, it's like this doesn't, you know, what's happening that's making it not do this? And what I came up with was, I think, kind of a simple, very simplistic look at this. And I wrote about it in our last client quarterly. Essentially, and this is something actually that goes back, but essentially the money printing that has gone on has been used to fill a gaping hole in the financial system.
Yeah.
All of the bad debt, the poorly executed loans that were done on people who shouldn't have gotten houses, the bad dealings with securitization, et cetera, all the things that went on, and particularly when it centralized around the banking financial industry, all of that money that would be normally used to inflate assets overall and cause inflation in the daily lives of individuals was really pouring into this big vat, this crevasse. And maybe it's a little bit to the point of it's getting filled at this point, and that's why the Fed, for example, is tapering their bonds. But that's why we didn't have inflation, because it didn't actually, even though some of it entered, we got, yes, we did get inflation in the form of a wealth effect with stocks and some other commodities, but not your everyday living in terms of spending inflation. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, exactly. The stimulus and the quantitative easing and the fiscal deficits have not gone into bank lending. Normally, the Fed injects money into the banking system, and the banks lend more money to people who want to borrow. But people don't want to borrow. Consumers don't want to borrow. Businesses don't want to borrow because they overexpanded in the great bubble that peaked in late 2007, as I predicted 20 years before this. So the money instead has gone into speculation. Banks, investment banks, leveraged hedge funds and private equity funds and traders have used these ultra-low interest rates, short-term and long-term, to borrow money cheap and leverage up their investments and bet on these risk-on assets, commodities, stocks. Even real estate is having a rebound despite very poor demographic trends ahead because people are looking for somewhere to get yield above a 0% T-bill or a 2.5% 10-year Treasury bond. So, yes, it has not gone into expanding the economy, and even major companies are using these low interest rates to buy back their own stocks, borrow and buy back their own stocks. And companies have huge amounts of money on their balance sheets. They're not putting it into an investment for expansion, so we're not going to see an expansion, and demographic and debt trends point down. So I think this artificial recovery from endless, unprecedented government stimulus around the world, QE and everything else and deficit, is about to come to an end, and we're going to see a bigger crash between mid-2014 and late-2016 and further down the line until demographic trends turn up into at least early-2020 or so. So investors need to say, look, we keep seeing every bubble take stocks higher, especially now with the government stimulus off the chart. You need to take money off the table and get safe and wait for the next crash, which I think is going to happen between 2014 and 2016. And I think the Dow is going to go as high as 17,000 and then crash to as low as 5,500 to 6,000 in the next few years. You need to get out of the way and wait to rebuy when things crash.
You know, it's interesting because I think I mentioned to you that, you know, I'm looking at the real estate in South Florida, and everywhere is around the country is different. And there is now in Miami, for example, there is, you know, the people with sealed bids again, and they're coming in with a bid over the top of another bid, and you're seeing a lot of cash transactions go on. Recently, we saw that mortgage applications were down. New home sales were down significantly. Existing home sales inventories are rising a bit. At the same time, though, you're seeing that foreclosures, for example, in where I live in Broward County, there are none to speak of, because what's happening is that there is a significant amount of individuals from outside the U.S. that are looking to take their money out of the various governments because of their, you know, out of the circulation.
Like the Chinese.
Right,
like the Chinese and the Brazilians, yeah.
Right. And what's happening is that they are putting it to work in, you know, in property here, so they can, for a lot of different reasons, but they're doing it on an all-cash basis, which is fascinating. What does that tell you?
Well, not only foreign buyers, but hedge funds and pension plans and stuff are buying foreclosed real estate and looking to either flip it or more likely to rent it out. And the rental market is good for the next several years by our demographic projections, but it's getting crowded now that everybody's jumping into it. So this is a sign of speculation. Again, when the Federal Reserve pushes short-term rates to zero and long-term rates to 1.5% to 2.5% on a 10-year Treasury bond, it just tells everybody you've got to trade up and speculate more in stocks, commodities, gold, real estate and stuff, and it just creates another bubble. Again, I keep telling people, keep saying, oh, the Fed's going to run into inflation and that's going to kill their stimulus. No, that's not what I'm worried about. They've created another bubble that has taken stocks to new highs in the worst economic environment since the 1930s, and it's the bubble that's going to burst, that's going to kill these financial institutions, going to kill the affluent people that are still spending money, and they're the only ones spending money, the top 10 to 20% who benefited from this rebound in financial assets because they control most of them. Homer Simpson, the everyday person, peaked in spending, as we predicted 20 years ago in 2007, and they're still sucking wind. So we're not going to get a turnaround here. This is artificial, and I think the China bubble is showing cracks, major cracks. It's the biggest bubble I've ever studied in 400 years of history. It is going to burst, and when it does, it's going to be like the Japanese in the late 80s. They were at the top of their demographic and debt and real estate bubble, and they had all this wealth, and they were buying real estate around the world in California and New York and Australian places. Well, the Chinese are doing the same thing today. They are keeping Vancouver, Toronto, Sydney, Melbourne, San Francisco, L.A., New York, London going up with these $100 million condo buys of extreme, and this is going to crash pretty soon because the Chinese are going to get their ass kicked from investing so much in real estate when their bubble, the biggest in history, at 30 times income in the typical large city in China, will burst bigger than any bubble in U.S. history and or modern global history. Mark my words on this.
You know, China is clearly showing their economics are softening. You know, and then at first, I find it really funny. You know, we see these economic numbers. So let's say that we have their manufacturing that comes in at, I don't know, pick a number, 52 when it was maybe 53. Then it goes to 51. Then all of a sudden it slips down to 49. And you know what? Everybody say, oh, temporary slowdown, which it may be, by the way. Then we have the same thing happening in the U.S., right? We have, oh, the weather. The weather, it's going to be a temporary situation.
The weather. Yeah.
Everything's the weather. The weather and the companies are blaming it. And we buy this. We kind of just suck all this up and say, oh, we believe this. Meanwhile, when the other side comes and we see that there should have been a return to buying, and we did see a much higher consumer spending recently on a month-over-month basis. But again, remember where the comparables were. You could say, well, the reason it was so high is not that it's so good. It's because, if you're going to tell me about the weather, it was because of the weather that really cut things down. And when you do a month-over-month, obviously it's a better number. But the trend clearly in China, I don't think there's any question about this, it's down.
It's down. It's down. Even the Chinese government is trying to ratchet it down somewhat because they want to create a soft landing. Let me tell you, Andrew, I've been through this soft landing argument, and bubbles don't burst throughout my entire 30-year research. Bubbles only burst. They don't correct. You cannot have a soft landing after you create through low interest rates and over government investment and all these things. And China is the worst on this, two times over from any country in the world. You cannot create a soft landing. And Europe, which is struggling to turn around, has the stalwart economy, Germany, with the worst demographic trends I see anywhere in the world in the next 8 years, worse than what I saw in 1989 for Japan. In 1989, I said Japan was going to have a decade plus of crash, and the U.S. and Europe were going to have their best stock markets and economy since the 1920s. Nobody saw that. That was just simply demographics. Germany and then many more countries in Europe, Italy, and on to follow, are going to go in the deepest demographic downturn we have seen anywhere in the world after Japan in the 1990s. And so how is Germany going to hold up the European Union? I say we're getting near a peak. The next 6 years, by all of my cycles, I have four long-term cycles, demographic, geopolitical, commodity cycles, which affects third world countries, and a decennial cycle that all point down from early to mid 2014 into late 2019 or early 2020. The only time I've seen these four cycles point down at the same time was 1930 to 1934, and we know what happened then. I think we're going to have the biggest downturn of our lifetimes ahead, and investors and businesses need to wake up and say, hey, we got to prepare for this. If you do, the bargains in investments in the next several years are going to be unprecedented. And for businesses, the businesses that hunker down and survive are going to gain more market share than they ever did in the boom and are going to dominate their industry for decades. So I see this as the most threatening time in our lifetimes and economic cycles, but also the most opportune if you see it coming.
You know, it's interesting because I think that, you know, if you look back over the different cycles that we've seen in the past, and you see, you know, for example, you look back and you look at, okay, well, you know, the short-term turndown in let's talk about the late 80s, then, of course, you know, you see the 90s, 1994 was not fun, even though it wasn't, you know, really, really bad. Then you look at, you know, what happened in, you know, the 2000s, early 2000s, that is, and 2003-ish. How quickly people forget that it is all cycles. Now, whether it's cycles that can be predicted or it's cycles that occur, these things, we go from boom to bust, right? Or you go from peak to trough, however you want to look at it. And you go through this whole level of continual cycling because everything gets pushed too far in any direction all the time. I don't think that there's ever been a case, and that goes right into your discussion of soft landing, and there's never been a case where everything is just, you know, three little bears kind of you know, just right and just, you know, a Disney-esque ending to any of this, whether it's the move on the downside, which you see that, you know, it moved much greater than we anticipated, anybody anticipated, to the downside or to the upside. So what is it that creates this kind of, too much confidence in any one direction? Is it an emotional issue? Is it a financial? What does this?
No, it is, Andrew. It is human nature. We think, we like to think, and we want the world to grow incrementally and up and up and up and up and up and then die and go to heaven. That's not the way the world goes, at least on Earth. We have exponential cycles up through demographic trends, technological innovation, and then once these cycles build, like in 1994 to 2008 or 1914 to 1928, 29, and the great boom back then. Once cycles build, they go exponential. People get overconfident. Human nature says, the longer I see a trend go up, the more confident I am in it. That is horribly wrong. The value investors, the Warren Buffetts of the world, the more something goes up, the more they see the downside risk. That is reality, because everything goes up cyclically and exponentially in cycles. And then when those bubbles, especially when it's a bubble, like in the recent periods, when they burst, it's like 2000, 2002, or 2008, 2009, or now I see a bigger bubble bursting between 2014, 2016. When they burst, it's equally exponential on the downside. So people get overconfident. They ride the trend. That's the herd that goes off the cliff. And I think we're about to go off the cliff here.
You know, I find that one of the things that's very interesting is the amount of share buybacks, increase in dividends. And obviously, a lot of that is predicated on the fact that we have a low interest rate environment that's allowing companies to do a tremendous job at engineering finance. In other words, they are able to take shares off the market.
Yeah.
I keep talking about this, and I think it's absolutely something that nobody looks at. And if you listen to the folks on TV and you listen to the all the talking heads about how Company A, Company B, they're beating earnings, but you see that revenues are falling. For example, IBM has recently had, just this quarter, their worst earnings growth rate that I've seen in decades, down 15% on a year-over-year quarterly basis, down 15% in terms of their earnings. And meanwhile, what does the company do? The company says they're not going to be doing their buybacks as much right now, but about 3 days later, they come out and they say they're going to increase their dividend by X amount percent. And the stock after the earnings, there's a lot of disappointment. And meanwhile, it goes down. And then it just 3 days later, it's kind of towards the point where it was before, because now what's happening is I think that people have substituted the idea of, oh, you know, the Fed's involved, interest rates are low, and of course we think they're going to be low forever. How can they go up? I mean, and these are ridiculously low interest rates. And even if we come back to the lowest end of an average long-term interest rate cycle, you got to think, I don't know, 3% on 2% on a Fed rate? That's really low to begin with. And if that's the case, and if people are chasing this for yield, I think they forgot about the fact that stocks have the ability to go down, wiping out your yield entirely. One of the concerns I have is that all these people that are chasing for yield, and you can get some pretty good yield on stocks these days.
Yeah, on stocks.
Really good yield, actually. Comparative yield and nominal yield. You can get really good yield. And I have this fear that those people that are risk-averse, that have entered into the markets, that are looking for yield and chasing yield, that have picked up these various stocks, whatever they are, regardless of what the earnings outlook is, et cetera, are going to be the first to exit, causing some kind of significant I don't want to call it a flush, but, you know, this a start to the downturn.
Yeah, I mean, I hope they're the first to exit, and I would advise them to do that. People are chasing these 2, 3, 4% dividend yields on global stocks, you know, major companies that are diversified around the world, thinking, hey, I'm safe here. And especially, let's say I invest in Procter & Gamble and they sell staples everywhere in the world. How are their sales going to go down even if we have a downturn? That's not the point. The point is that when stock markets see and investors see increasing risk and global downturns and geopolitical risk and all the things we're seeing in this period, when things go down, all stocks go down. The price to earnings ratios goes down, even on a Procter & Gamble that is selling, you know, everyday goods and toilet paper. And people don't realize that, so they're thinking, oh, I've got this 2 to 3% dividend yield, I'll be okay. And you know what? In the Great Depression, when stocks went down 89% at the worst and then came back later, the dividend yielding stocks did the best, but they still lost money. I'm like, get out of the way. We've seen two bubbles burst, 2000, 2002, 2008 to 2009, and I think another one, 2014 to 16, and then another one after that, 2019 to 20 or so, before we get out of this demographic downturn and turn back up. Get out of the way. Don't hold out for that 3% dividend when even your less volatile stocks like Procter & Gamble might just go down 30, 40, 50% instead of 50, 60, 70, 80%, as I expect a lot of stocks to go down. That's still not a good deal. Don't look a gift horse in the mouth. We've had the greatest bubble in history. It's been extended from 2009 to 2014, courtesy of the Fed, with low interest rates. And like you said, companies are buying back their stock, increasing their earnings per share artificially. Their borrowing costs have gone down dramatically, increasing their earnings artificially. And the economy is rebounded artificially from all of this stuff. This is not going to last. Unless you believe that you can create money out of thin air and cover over the biggest debt bubble and financial bubble in history and somehow come out of this okay, which Japan has already proven you can't after 2.5 decades, then you need to protect yourself here. Just get safe and wait for the next crash. I'm telling you, if it doesn't happen in the next couple of years, I'm going to probably quit my profession and be a limo driver in Australia, you know?
Nice. And by the way, you talk about Procter & Gamble. I mean, just to really put a final point on this, you know that, hey, they sell toilet paper around the world and everybody needs toilet paper, right?
Yeah.
Well, my friend, I've been to many places that don't use toilet paper.
Yeah, and, in Africa.
yeah. I mean, it's parts of Asia. And the fact is, whether or not you find that disgusting or not, that's just the way it is. And they swear it's cleaner and they think it's disgusting using toilet paper. But the point is that maybe they're using toilet paper as a, you know, possibly as a change in their overall way of doing things. They're looking at it maybe as a luxury item. But the fact is that when push comes to shove and they're looking at food versus toilet paper, and again, we are talking about different countries around the world that have a much lower pay scale and wage than we do, the decision will be made, hey, I'm going to eat and I'm going to go back to using the hose.
So here's the thing, Andrew. I agree with the long-term argument that emerging countries are going to become more middle class, but their middle class is $5,000 to $10,000,
right,
per capita income, not $50,000 or $40,000 in Europe and the United States. They will never be as rich as us. I have documented this unbelievably, and it's crystal clear. But they are going to grow more middle class. They're going to need more commodities. They're going to need more toilet paper. They're going to need more energy, all this stuff. But there's another cycle I study. It's a 30-year commodity cycle that peaked between 2008 and 2011, right on track, but, you know, back to 1980 and 1950 and 1920 and back hundreds of years before that. When these commodity cycles turn down, which they are turning down, emerging markets, these emerging countries, they're commodity exporters. That's their biggest industries, and that's their best jobs. And when commodity prices go down, they suffer. And so the emerging countries, I think, are going to do worse than anybody in the next 6 to 10 years. But when we turn around in the next global boom, they will be the best. And we will probably see the greatest commodity boom in history when emerging countries with their demographics are driving the next boom and developed countries are not. They're going sideways, a few countries up, many countries sideways, and many countries down.
We're already seeing that. I mean, we're already seeing that Latin America is having significant problems. And
Brazil's stock markets are down 50% from the top.
Yep.
India's
and
down 20%.
China hasn't ever recovered.
China is back near their lows in late 2008.
Yep.
What does that tell you?
Yep.
Emerging countries may be the future long term. They are the hardest hit in this downturn. They are the tail from the dog, and that has always been the case.
Yep. Well, Harry Dent, again, author of Demographic Cliff and the free daily newsletter you can get over at harrydent.com. Survive and Prosper. It's totally free. You get it. He writes it daily, talks about a variety of different things, whether it comes to markets or economies around the world. Good stuff to have in your arsenal to understand what's happening in a much different way than you'll hear from the talking heads, and not just a bullish or a bearish. It'll go both sides of it, depending on what not only the cycles are, but the economics, the demographics, all the good things that go into that. So go over to harrydent.com and get your free edition of Survive and Prosper. Mr. Dent, always a pleasure.
Okay, thank you, Andrew. Again.
All right, talk to you soon, buddy boy. Bye. I mentioned at the top of the show that I want to talk to you about some of the headline fiasco that's been going on. Now, it's interesting that, as I've told you time and time again, that we have to be very, very careful about watching the headlines and what they say, but what they really mean. You know, underneath the headline and the information that is passed through in a very short snippet, we have to look at what's going on in terms of the actual news item and actually what the information is all about. Now, I want to tell you something that interesting happened, and I want to tell you that it was really helpful that the analysis came through from one of the sources we use for news, and that's briefing.com. And what happened was that on the earnings release from Open Table, which is symbol OPEN, Open Table, there was a revenue miss by a significant amount. Now, that's at least what we saw when it came to the headlines from other news sources. A lot of news sources had been reporting that there was a miss. Now, what's interesting about that is that Briefing dug into it and found that, hey, wait a second, there's some incorrect information here, because what's being reported actually is only the headline number for revenue that is domestic, not the entire international component. Now, the stock was down about 6% in the after hours after this came out, and it was kind of dropping a bit, and then it leveled off. Now, as I got further into the information, I saw, yeah, you know what, there is something that is right about this. Corrections started to come in about the revenue number from the sources that had the wrong information to begin with. Now, what do you do with that? Well, that's a buying opportunity. You see that there is an aberration due to incorrect data that is being looked at as a source of information for buying or selling in the after hours. And we picked up a small piece of Open Table for our clients in the TDIMG Managed Growth Portfolio. And if you look at where Open Table finished the day on Friday, it was up about 4.5%. Now, you took a swing from down 6% to plus 5%. That's about a 10%, 11%. Now, we didn't catch all of it. We caught about 9% of it or so, or 8% of it, maybe 8.5%, 9%. But what's interesting is this is exactly what I've been talking about for a while, is to watch the data and watch what you're looking at, because it may not be exactly the right information that you're really focusing on, because the headlines may either be incorrect or misrepresented. This may be an extreme case of what happened and how things work, but I've told you time and time again that you have to really be very, very careful of looking at just the headlines, because it does, these things kind of happen. And I think it was very important to look at the this situation and bring it to you, because these are extreme circumstances, but yet they do cause these types of situations to come about and for you to make some money from it. I think it's very important for you to do that and look at that on a regular basis. Now, what's going on with bonds? Have you been watching bonds? You know, we have the Fed, who on Wednesday said they were going to be cutting down their bond purchases by another $10 billion, down to $45 billion from where they were, which was $85 billion on a monthly basis. And yet we're seeing that bonds are not reacting accordingly. In fact, if you look at what's going on with bonds, you'll notice that there was an incredible amount of movement to the downside. In other words, they were selling bonds for a while when the number came out on Friday, and that was a recovery from what was happening on Thursday. In fact, Thursday, they were buying bonds ahead of the number, which was interesting, but yet didn't explain a lot, because there's a lot of optimism going into it. Now, you know, what they say is that the bond market is a lot smarter than the stock market. In other words, the bond players out there seem to have a much better edge on what's going on around the world, economics and political issues, than the stocks ever do, and stock investors. And this is something that you hear as a common discussion and something that you want to pay attention to. And on Friday, we saw that there was a significant move to sell bonds initially on the information that was released about the 6.3% unemployment rate and the 280,000+ jobs added. But all of a sudden, about early part of the morning into midday, bonds started turning around, and all of a sudden they were being bought. And that was very interesting. Why is that? With the fact that the Fed is going to be taking their bond purchases down, and the fact that we're seeing better economic numbers, you would think that the dollar should be going higher, and you would think that the bonds would be sold. That makes sense. Yet we saw that the dollar was moving lower towards the middle of the day and into the afternoon, and in fact that bonds were being bought pretty aggressively. Why? Is it simply that there is this weekend risk that is going on, that is playing out, and that we're seeing that that nobody wants to be holding, and they'd rather be long bonds rather than stocks into a weekend where who knows what can happen with political issues around the world? Is it that the realization is that China is slowing down, and that we're seeing that Europe may not be able to do their quantitative easing program as they've discussed? And the fact is that that even though there is a good jobs number, maybe something underneath the surface wasn't as good.
We did, of course, see that manufacturing was a bit better also in the U.S. Factory orders did slip. We saw that factory orders were not up to what the expectation was. In fact, they were about 1.1% on factory orders and looking for about a 1.7 to 1.8 number on a gain, depending on where you look in terms of the estimates. But overall, the fact is that we still saw that there was weakness in some of the space when it came to tech again. We saw that, for example, LinkedIn was down about 8 to 9% after their earnings. They fell short. Their outlook was questionable at best. And we're still seeing that there's a lot of selling that's going on in the space. In fact, over the weekend, Barron's came out with a discussion about how Twitter may be still 25% overvalued. And I found that very interesting. We also saw that oil was moving lower, natural gas was moving lower, and gold was climbing. We just talked about gold a little bit, about possibly where it's going to go, and then where it's going to end up down, according to Harry Dent. But the fact of the matter is that we saw a very risk, termed as a risk-off trade at the end of the day on Friday. It is possible that it was all about just a weekend holding position and a question about that, but I would say that there's still something underlying all of this, and that we have to realize that with the 800,000 reduction in the overall workforce and workplace and the amount of people that left entirely is saying something. I'm also sticking to my guns about the real estate market, and the fact of the matter is that even though we did see real estate stocks come up a little bit because they react very positively to lower interest rates, there still is a big question as to the overbuilding that's going on in certain areas and the spring selling season, which I've talked about a few times in the past. So that kind of gives us a bit of a rounding. Next couple of weeks are going to be some of the final numbers in terms of the earnings season, which we are seeing pretty much matched expectations in terms of the beats versus the surprises on the way down in terms of earnings. We're seeing about 70% of the companies have beaten estimates on earnings. And, of course, we're seeing that about 52% have beat on revenue. That's pretty much par for the course when it comes to earnings seasons and on average what we've seen lately. But, again, if you see any of the earnings trends that we've been talking about for some time, clearly when it comes to the year-over-year on a quarterly basis and the earnings and EPS trends, they have been pretty lousy overall, especially for the bigger companies. And the money that's been going into those, because there's a safety play going on due to the higher dividends and the desire to move out of some of the more aggressive names, has been continuing to play out. And even though last week we did see a little bit of a bounce on some of those, I still think there's some downside risk, not only to them, but I would not be surprised if we start getting to a level here where there is some skepticism. Don't forget, it's May. What do they say? Sell in May, go away? It's possible. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, it is with the run that we've had in the last several weeks and looking at the earnings, looking at the economics, looking at the political and worldwide landscape of what's going on right now, it wouldn't be surprising if we see a little bit of a correction going on right here. In fact, we've seen that some of our indicators are peaking out recently on the overbought side. And I think that is something that needs to be reckoned with. We put up a post last week on thedisciplinedinvestor.com about the Spearman indicator, which has been a pretty good indicator when it starts to roll, to start taking for cover a little bit and to getting a little bit more concerned about what the outlook is. And we'll see over the next few weeks with the last bit of earnings that comes out, how this plays out. Be aware of headlines. Be aware of the fact that, you know, we are in a situation where there's political uncertainty around the world, and some of the recent moves may be exaggerated. Last people kind of running to get in, money coming out of international and into domestic, out of the U.S. and into the U.S. So some of that, we'll see how long that takes to dry up and where that plays out. And don't forget about the fact that we do have record buybacks that are going on, and we'll see how that plays. Other than that, I want to tell you that if you are interested in trigger charts, of course, over on TradeStation, that's available. We have a new indicator that's going up. Plus, for those of you that are subscribers, there's a brand new autopilot that is a multi-time frame on one row that is really incredible, that's going to be coming out this week. And also, if you're interested in managed money, we have the Aero strategy, which is a very simple but yet elegant strategy that works on the SPY, the S&P 500 ETF, in, out, short. Right now, it's in an out position. In other words, it's out of shorts or longs. It's in cash right now. Usually doesn't stay there very long. We'll see what happens here. We'll have to see if there's a break. Looks like the break on the downside is the next move that is going to trigger a short position, but we'll see how that plays out according to the algorithm. Of course, you can get information on that over on the website, thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And you can also get information on the TDI managed growth strategy there as well. Any questions, ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And I'll tell you, if now you think the markets are overvalued, it may be just the time to make a change in your investments. Send it over to Horowitz & Company, and we'll see which one fits you the best. One of the strategies of all the three, the global allocation, the Arrow, TDI managed growth strategy. Until next week, I'll see you soon. Have a very profitable week. And of course, wish your mother a happy Mother's Day for me. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.